take your protein pills. The Poisoned Electric Head Story.
Chapter 38. The Italian Job. It's 1992, and Maurizio Grazza picks up an album in a Venice record store. Intrigued by the Geiger-esque artwork and dome-head aliens on the cover, he decides to buy it and likes the music. It's right up his strata. Fast forward 2 years, and the space agency have established a contact in Italy for touring psychedelic bands. The water is tested by various members of the Gong family and found to be very nice indeed, thank you. So the next step is to send a comprehensive list of represented artists to the promoter for further tours. It lands on his desk, and one name leaps out from the others. It's the band from the Strange album he bought a few years ago. So he contacts a bemused Steve Bates and proposes a tour. These were the fortunate circumstances that led to us being offered a 6-date tour of Italy by an agent we hadn't heard from in years, who'd probably forgotten we were still on his books. No doubt it was the last response he was expecting, but business is business, thus negotiations were commenced. I won't bore you with the details of infighting twixt agents and managers, but the whole thing nearly didn't happen, as everyone argued over commissions and exclusivity rights, driving us to despair, but at least making us feel wanted again. In the end, the deals were struck, and we set about the practicalities. We had to organise our own transport, but everything else was included. So with half the cash up front, we hired a minibus and surreptitiously took half the seats out. On top of everything else, fate had thrown another spanner in the works, one which would put me through the ringer, haul me over the coals, and leave me to this day still ill at ease with the mercenary, cold-hearted tendencies I evidently possess. My girlfriend Jo had been to the doctors over a minor complaint, and her routine blood test results arrived 2 days before the tour started. They weren't conclusive, but the initial evidence pointed towards either a blood cell imbalance, or more seriously, leukemia. A lumbar puncture was scheduled for the day we were due to leave, the results of which would take a week to materialise. The question was, where would I be while she sweated it out? By her side or living it up in Italy? If I stayed, then the tour would have to be scrapped without question. But if I went, then what kind of callous bastard did that make me? True, there was nothing I could do, short of playing the waiting game with her, but that was all she wanted. I asked several people for guidance, and Jo included, they all said it must be my decision. On the day of the tests, we went together to the hospital, and after an excruciating procedure, I helped her outside where two vehicles were waiting, her parents' car and a minibus with the seats taken out. Up to that point, nobody knew which I was going to choose, aside from me, who, still unsure of the wisdom of my decision, boarded the latter. One agonising week later, Jo got the all clear, and soon recovered, unlike our relationship, which from that moment died a prolonged, embittered death, finally giving up the ghost just under a year later. The journey to Italy was the usual drunken spectacle, involving a couple of nights roughing it in France along the way. Parking areas and service stations, as ever, provided the sleeping facilities. I recall a night of confusion, revolving around the toilets at one spot, as no one could figure out what actually was a toilet. Various metal troughs looked promising, but it was far from explanatory, even for someone of AF's scatological expertise. Things were about to get more comfortable, though, as the days progressed, for once we hit Milan, we would be guests of our old friend Sunscape, who had offered to put us up until the tour kicked in. When we arrived, they gave us board for 2 days and kept us in booze, pasta and espresso, until the first night of the tour, where they did the support slot. We spent those days mostly buying wine in supermarkets, amazed at the cheap prices. In fact, it's amazing how easily pleased the English become at the sight of cheap booze. The taste is only slightly soured by the knowledge that back in the UK, we're screwed rotten by high prices and draconian licensing laws. There's frequent talk of relaxing them and adopting a more continental approach, but after so many years of cultivating the English drinking mentality, it would never work. You can't lock a dog in a yard and beat it every day. Then one day take it to the park and let it off the leash. It'd have some kiddie's face off within seconds, then Scarpa, and you'd never see it again. Back in England was where my own thoughts were, as I rang home every night to check on Jo. I could feel her fear down the phone, tinged with a resigned disappointment in me, and each night I hung up and joined the psycho shenanigans for some respite in oblivion. Wine bottles were being necked as if they were cans of lager. AF and Bill were buying them three at a time. On the day of the first concert, we went to the designated hotel to meet the tour managers. The place was a sumptuous chateau and elegant enough to stun us into cap-ringing politeness. Waiting in the foyer were Maurice and his wife Ophelia and Beppe, a Gainsbourgian rake in a team Daiwa cap. The fishing reference immediately sparked a rapport between him and Bun, which, as Beppe spoke no English, consisted of monosyllabic exchanges, mostly the word fish, accompanied by extravagant angling gestures. They helped us check in, kick-starting one of the enduring phenomena of the tour, the single room. As we were a travelling party of nine, we were booked into four doubles and one single, with this minor detail growing in importance when we weighed up the implications. After days of living in each other's pockets, the thought of some splendid isolation was alluring enough, but add five-star luxury and 24-hour soft porn TV to the equation, and you can see the appeal to a horny hungover guy who's missing his squeeze back home. Thus the single room rapidly acquired cult status amongst us, eventually being immortalised in song on 1996's The Hanged Man album. Later at the venue, we were treated to more luxury in the form of a veritable smorgasbord of exotic cheeses, the likes of which we'd only seen in Tom and Jerry cartoons. If it seems like I'm laying on the Innocents Abroad motif a bit thick here, you must remember we were just ordinary northern lads. Plus, on one of our last ventures abroad, we'd had a bucket of shit thrown over us, so this hospitality was far from lost on us. It was alarming, though, how in a mere matter of days, some of us began echoing Nigel Tufnell in Spinal Tap's infamous Bigger Bread scene, finding fault in the tiniest things. One important thing that had to be decided before things got underway was the question of equipment security. And this boiled down to one person sleeping in the van every night, regardless of the ostentatious facilities of each hotel. The furthest way to do this was to draw place names out of a hat, with each person being responsible for the gear for that day and night, only handing over the reins the next morning. With bated breath, I reached in and drew Florence, and as the itinerary also included Rome, Milan and Venice, it was hard to gauge the misfortune of my choice. I guess it was a no-win situation all round. For 24 hours you were denied any sightseeing privileges, barred from the restaurant and hotel, and condemned to sit in morbid solitude with only guitar amps for company, while a stone's throw away, the splendour of Renaissance Italy shimmered and throbbed. P was first up, as he had drawn Milan. So after a storming gig for both bands, we followed Maurice's car to the restaurant to discover that we were the only customers, and it had stayed open specially. On top of this, the girl serving us was the most delectable creature I'd ever laid eyes on. A smouldering, dusky, busty, bambi-eyed Latino goddess in figure-hugging black. Poor P never got to see her, just the menu and AF, who served him the dish of his choice with a carafe of wine in the back of the van. We could get used to this way of life, and that's what I was afraid of. Once the novelty wore off, our veneer of respectable conduct might just evaporate with it. AF had already demonstrated his lack of cultural tolerance in France when he inadvertently bought a carpaccio raw ham sandwich from a service station. One bite into it, his face dropped before exclaiming, "They've not even cooked it, the dirty gets!" With his dad working in an abattoir, he knew about these things and insisted we turn the van round and swat the bastards. He behaved himself that first night as we all did, but as the tour wore on, this brief hiatus of calm would prove to be short-lived. The next day's destination was Genoa, and Maurice had set up a personal appearance in a record shop within walking distance of the hotel. We decided that the four big mask wearers should attend, conveniently leaving Bill and AF to get shit-faced in the van. It was a bit chaotic getting suited and booted in the hotel, then negotiating the tiny lift to the foyer, even more so navigating the narrow winding back streets of Genoa. Maurice led the way, grinning with delight that that same album cover had come to life and was now following him down the road. But his delight was nothing, however, compared to the shop owner, who was positively beaming as he excitedly ushered us inside. The walls were covered with framed photos of psychedelic bands, old and new, and in the centre of each stood the shop owner, wearing the same broad grin. He was a crazy, beatific, long-haired, acid casualty with wild, sparkling eyes that seemed to belong to a much younger person. Mischievous toddler eyes. He had a look that said he'd lived through it all, and instead of sacrificing his innocence, he'd somehow regained it forever, and everything was going to be all right, daddy-o. You can find the same look in the eyes of David Allen and Arthur Brown. They're both over 50, so I guess it's something you don't obtain overnight, and for most of us, maybe never. But this guy had it in spades. It was evident that a visit to the shop was an integral part of the tour. The Who's Who gallery on the walls bore testimony to that. Gong, Hawkwind, and Osric Tentacles, to name but a few. And judging by the camera suddenly being brandished, Poisoned Electric Head. We assumed the position, and the deed was done. What promotional purpose any of this served is debatable. But it was fun all the same. And we were probably the most flamboyantly dressed act to turn up in a while. Our host greatly appreciated our attire, which is more than can be said for the Italian police waiting outside. Someone must have called them with reports of masked men in the area, and in this part of Italy, that meant only one thing. I remember exiting the shop full of bonhomie and instantly having the muzzle of a submachine gun pressed against my neck. The guy was ranting something at me angrily when our host appeared to try to alleviate the situation. He implored us to take off the masks, and we didn't need asking twice. There was much huffing and gesticulating, a little finger wagging, and some threatening stirs before they let us go. The words occupational hazard couldn't fail to spring to mind. We trundled back to the hotel, where the atmosphere was noticeably more relaxed, certainly from our comrades' perspectives, who were more than a little soused. I refused their offer to join them, and chose instead to see a little of Genoa. It was a labyrinth of narrow, winding streets, down one of which I stumbled upon a dozen huge posters for the concert. Macaroni Music had produced a design from one of our publicity shots, and on this scale it was certainly eye-catching. It remains one of my favourite photos of the band, me, Billy and Phil in our helmets. Despite them being identical, each of us has a different expression, determined solely by our eyes. I had the strange sensation of staring into the eyes of the middle figure, alone in the knowledge that they were my own eyes staring back at me. I stayed a while locked in retinal feedback and feeling like Clark Kent, as oblivious shoppers passed by. I returned to the hotel in time to leave for the venue, where someone had joined us in order to direct us through the confusing maze of traffic. Bill and AF were by now approaching critical mass and still clutching wine bottles, and no sooner had we left than AF announced he needed a piss and demanded we pull over. Our friend cautioned that in such traffic it would be impossible, so we told him he would have to wait. As we navigated the tiny congested streets, he grew increasingly irate at our refusal to stop, before opening the sliding door and pissing up the side of the van. It was a fine way to arrive, and a delightful impression to make on our perturbed guide and passers-by. After unloading the gear, we took stock of our surroundings and found ourselves in an old-style theatre with circle and balconies. AF had already found the dressing room, for he appeared suddenly at the top of a small staircase, clutching a dozen cans triumphantly. "Who wants a beer?" he cried, before toppling over, sending the lot and himself clattering to the bottom. During the sound check, he consistently badgered the PA guys for weed. The space agency had warned us that bringing anything through could jeopardise the whole shebang, so everyone was clean. But by now the potheads were beginning to cold turkey, not having smoked anything since arriving in Milan. The Italian roadies stirred nonplussed as AF's loud requests for marijuana failed to register. But the guy from the hotel relented, and a small away team eventually went off in search of some. What transpired is either testimony to AF's balls of steel or his stupidity. But Billy returned ashen-faced, with tales of AF refusing the pot proffered and lunging at a guy's pocket to get the weed they'd sampled instead. And this was in a dark warehouse surrounded by good fellas sitting on packing crates, and possibly packing heat themselves. The crowd at the gig was slightly smaller than the night before, but there were bound to be off nights along the way. Maybe the 12-piece Satanist support act had put a few people off. In the restaurant afterwards, Saucy Jack was uncharacteristically boisterous, then suddenly became sick as a dog. But as you know who was confined to the van, there were no untoward scenes. The next morning saw a more reserved AF, who was suffering the hangover from hell. And one thing that was always in short supply when we were out together was sympathy. Whether you'd accidentally slammed your fingers in the door or were suffering from any amount of ailments, the result was always the same, relentless mocking laughter and abuse. As we drove off, AF's vomiting fits invoked shrieks of amusement. We howled as he groaned in misery. We roared as he spluttered and gagged. Tears rolled down our cheeks as he stuck his head out of the window and chucked up over a stylish couple passing on a Lambretta. We were heartless, unfeeling bastards. Our motto was, a friend in need is hilarious. Eventually, AF was laughing with us, and before long he was back on the vino. For who needs a hangover cure when you're on the receiving end of a piss-taking, cackling bunch of harpies? Next up was Rome, and Saucy Jack was the poor unfortunate on guard duty. He forced a smile as we bounded off en masse in the general direction of the Colosseum. This was our first afternoon without an agenda, so to make up for what we'd not seen of Milan and Genoa, we were determined to drink it all in, metaphorically of course. We were too streetwise and tight to be stung for a fiver a beer. As soon as our impending Italian trip became common knowledge, we were treated to a litany of cautionary tales from all and sundry concerning exorbitant prices. It was well meant, but it was also a spin on the old "if you go, you'll be sorry" line, touted around to those foolhardy enough to stray from small towns. "No good'll come of it, mark my words. You'll be laughing on the other side of your face. Don't come crying to me. You'll come down to earth with a bump. They think it's all fun and games. You won't be told," and on, ad infinitum. Well, we'd had a bellyful of it, and besides, we didn't need telling, as you would have been hard-pushed to find a more suspicious, never-off-the-guard bunch of cutthroats. We fired round all the sights, hungry for culture, but scrupulously avoiding the pay-to-view. The Sistine Chapel involved a cab ride, so that was out, but we took in the Trevi Fountain, where I didn't even throw a coin in, so ingrained was my thriftiness, choosing instead to buy foot powder from a chemist's opposite instead. Touring plays havoc with your feet. I guess that's why I've never been back to Rome. When we returned to the van, there was just time for Saucy to do a whistle-stop dash to one or two sites, so he was happy. In the evening, we located the venue, which was bang in the heart of Vatican City, right behind the Vatican, in fact. Conventional thinking wouldn't entertain such a notion, imagining some distance between the sacred and secular. But there it was, next to the big fella's house, complete with cardboard box-dwelling tramp asleep in the doorway. It was called The World, a vast place with superior amenities, and after the sound check we wandered around the area in the early twilight. I found myself in the company of Billy, by accident or design I don't recall, but this was one of the advantages of being a large outfit. You could pick and choose and mix and match, depending on your mood. You were never faced with the Weller dilemma of hanging out with Bruce or Rick. No, we could chop and change our way through the mathematical possibilities a 9-piece touring band afforded with ease. Often, it was down to changing your socks at the wrong time. You'd turn your back for too long, and they'd be away. And other times, it was personal choice. On this occasion, Billy and me found ourselves wandering through the arches and paths of the Vatican, discussing the deep and meaningful in the contemplative surroundings. An occasional passing Monsignor tipped us a respectful nod, which we politely returned. A time of peaceful reflection. One of the requirements of our hotel was that we leave our passports behind reception. But this wasn't a fact we chose to reflect upon in any shape or form. Unlike our bandmates, who were up against a wall at gunpoint again, being harassed for some form of ID. This time it was the secret police who had stalked this conspicuously dressed bunch, as in Scruffy. Don't laugh, it could be you. A Tommy Hilfiger top won't cut it over there. Over several blocks before apprehending them. Meanwhile, on the floor, I spotted a discarded souvenir print of a Roman senator, which I duly rolled up and pocketed. Back at the venue, we geared up for another mammoth gig, but it wasn't to be, as the turnout was less than overwhelming, unlike the previous nights. Ophelia and the gang were cool about it, but the bottom line was there was nobody. Not one living soul paid to come in. We'd been in this situation more than once in the past in England, and we just played anyway and treated it as a practice, albeit an expensive one. But here, we weren't sure of the protocol. When in Rome and no bugger turns up, what do the Romans do? In the end, Bun made the move and invited the bloke from the cardboard box inside. We offered to keep him supplied with booze and entertained, but even he refused. Some nights you just can't give it away, can you? Undeterred, we told the promoters that this one was for them, as a thank you for their hospitality, so to sit back and enjoy the show. Afterwards, we were handed a mobile in order to speak to Big Maurice. He was the man who had bankrolled the operation, and since day one the others had been maintaining close contact with him, keeping him informed about every detail of the proceedings. He had grown in our collective imaginations into a Blofeld figure, sitting in a 60s Icho Arnio ball chair, stroking a white Persian cat. We were understandably apprehensive about speaking to him, but he was dead relaxed about it, telling us not to worry and to treat the whole thing as a holiday. Little Maurice told us that he was a diamond merchant of considerable wealth and influence, whose second love was English psychedelic music. Lucky, eh? And he saw these tours as a pleasurable distraction from the world of hard business. Any losses he incurred were casually shrugged off, but it didn't make it feel any better, and we weren't naive enough to think he would continue throwing money at UK bands indefinitely. Still, we packed up the gear and it was off to the restaurant again. This time it was Al who couldn't keep anything down. 3 casualties in 3 nights. It felt like we'd picked up an invisible passenger who was picking us off one by one. This unknown entity we christened the Phantom. As well as possessing vomit-inducing powers, he could also conjure up drunken, loutish behaviour in otherwise placid individuals. And it was also reasonable to assume he'd had a hand in our drastic change in fortunes on the audience front. Yep, this Phantom guy was bad news all round. I awoke the next day, after a fitful night's sleep, sharing a room with Bill. We'd spent the evening drinking and channel hopping in a fruitless search for porn. Nothing quite fitted the bill, yet everything did. Every scene looked as though it could suddenly go X-rated. All the trappings were in place. Mini-skirted girls answering the door to the plumber, girls in silk negligees rolling seductively on beds whilst talking on the phone, but nothing ever got any further. Breakfast was also soured by the realisation that it was my turn to be on van duty. We were bound for Florence, the jewel in the crown of Renaissance Italy, and I wasn't going to see any of it. These were the breaks. On arrival in the centre, I was given 10 minutes to grab a few things, so I opted for a litre carton of white wine and some sweet bread. No, not sheep's bollocks. Things were depressing enough. And on the way back, I found a magazine with pictures from the Miss Italy finals in it. God, these continental girls. And they weren't just in the magazines. They were holding down everyday jobs everywhere you looked. It was evidently no big deal that Isabella Rossellini worked in the newsagents, because Penelope Cruz was working in the bakery next door. It was best not to dwell on it too much and not think about those stunningly average girls from your early teens who you venerated as goddesses, yet they didn't even know you existed. Mind you, I can't say I didn't divine some masochistic pleasure from it. One of my richest experiences was that of sitting on a hillside in Wales, high as a kite on mushrooms. The sun was setting, we were listening to Pink Floyd's Atom Heart Mother, and I was melting in the exquisite bittersweet pain of a recent breakup. I've never experienced such a pathos-seeped, poignant, crystalline sensation since. Thank you, S, wherever you are. And no, you aren't average, far from it, and no doubt still a goddess. Even today, when I listen to those Floyd tracks, I'm instantly transported back there. That particular day, I was being transported nowhere. I was staying put in an unremarkable car park while my comrades frolicked through a merchant ivory landscape. When they returned, they were full of awe and comments like, "Nicest place yet," and "Bloody amazing," which I interpreted as breathtaking scenery and no one pulled a gun on us. Then we drove to the outskirts, leaving the centre of Florence for me unseen. At the venue, we tucked into our downsized cheese fest. We'd actually requested less food out of guilt and as a cost-cutting exercise, and awaited the crowds. It was exactly the same story as Rome, but without the vagrant to swell the numbers. So this time we conceded to sensible opinion, and with heavy hearts set about dismantling the gear. And the PA guy shrugged, grunted, and did likewise. As we were checking the dressing room for belongings, Bill found my rolled-up senator picture. He stared at him for some moments wide-eyed, before exclaiming, "That's him! It's the Phantom!" and insisted that the only way of pulling out of this nosedive was to burn it. So we did just that in the club car park, dancing round his smouldering effigy as the PA guys trundled bass bins past us, clearly unimpressed. It was almost a relief later to sit in the back of the van alone with my pizza, rather than sharing the despondent atmosphere inside the restaurant with the others. There was one small indication that our exorcism had worked, however, for me at any rate. On arrival at the hotel, we discovered it provided a walled parking area with security cameras, so the boys decided I could sleep in the hotel after all, and I got the single room. The next day found Billy poring over the map at the breakfast table. "You know, Cesena isn't that far," he remarked. "We only have to leave at about 4 o'clock. So in the light of this, and as everyone had been blown away the first time, a second trip into Florence took place, and this time I was included. There was a subtle behavioural shift occurring. People were no longer getting wankered immediately after breakfast, but choosing to get high on the intoxicating scenery instead. With the likes of Bun and Billy, this had long been the case, but en masse, in 8 years, it had hitherto been unheard of. And things reached a peak in Florence that day. Saucy Jack offered to treat us all by paying for us to climb the bell tower of El Duomo, and as the view from the top promised to be spectacular, we jumped at the chance, though we hadn't bargained for the fact that hundreds of steps combined with a hangover was quite challenging. Another thing we'd overlooked was the time, for halfway up, the bells began chiming 12 noon. The noise was deafening, and the whole tower shook and swayed, but we finally made it to the top. As we stared at the panoramic terracotta landscape, a quite unfamiliar pin-dropping silence descended on us. Even Saucy Jack could only manage the occasional, hushed and reverent, "Fucking hell!" As for AF, you could almost see the layers of hard-bitten cynicism dropping away to reveal the wide-eyed innocent beneath. And AF didn't do wide-eyed. If you'd even seen his eyes, you were part of a small exclusive club. So, what had the band ever done for us, apart from fuck us over, lose us our girlfriends, and drag us below the poverty line? Well, it had brought us here to give us moments like this. As it turned out, Billy's travel estimations proved to be a little premature. On the map, Cesena was indeed no great distance, but in reality, it involved navigating perilous mountain roads flanked by deep ravines, so progress was slow. Sharp bends lurked around every corner, and it was the devil's own job to avoid careering over the edge and exploding in grand style. So much so that at one point we noticed a burning smell and quickly realised the front wheel was on fire. The brake shoes had ignited from overuse, and yellow flames were licking up the side of the van, We pulled over, and Billy made a frantic plea for something to extinguish it with. "Quick, give it here." But surely he didn't mean our beer. Had he lost his mind? The momentary standoff broke suddenly as Bill lunged. Bun didn't even see it coming as Bill whisked the mineral water out of his hands and doused the blaze. It was lucky Bun was aboard, or I don't know what we'd have done. We arrived in Cesena late, but in one piece, and for the life of me I can't remember a single thing about the gig, or anything else. Anyway, on to Venice. Ah, Venice. This was the last gig of the tour, and we were finally going to get to meet Big Morris. The concert venue, however, was away from the centre, far from the bridges and lagoons, so we briefly stopped at the perimeter, where vehicles were allowed, and hopped out for a glimpse. We had 10 minutes, just time enough to catch sight of a parked-up gondola, and then we were off. That's your lot. Arrivederci. P was furious. He even offered to pay for an extra day's van hire, if we could come back next day. And he was bang on when he said we might never get the chance to return. But what can you do? We were hitting the road first thing in the morning. We had some difficulty finding the venue. We knew it was some kind of community centre type place. So when we saw a likely looking building, we stopped and sent Billy in to investigate. Meanwhile, the sight of our van pulling up had triggered recognition with a group of guys who came running over to the fence to greet us. So it was obviously the place. They were a weird-looking bunch, though, in overalls and with teeth all over the place. One of them appeared to be eating dirt, and they were jumping up and down and laughing and waving. AF suddenly blurted out, "They're all fucking nuts!" and burst into his own deranged cackling hee-hee-ha. Billy came jogging out, shaking his head, to indicate we'd got the wrong place. And just then another van pulled up behind us, also a white minibus. This was the one designated to take the inmates on the daily excursion. It was time to beat a hasty retreat before any other mix-ups occurred. With our twisted entourage, it was wise not to tempt fate. At the real club, a cavernous place with half a double-decker bus sticking out of the wall, we finally got to meet Big Maurice. He was a Liam Neeson meet Gerard Depardieu type of guy, rugged but oozing style and charm. And the other promoters seemed slightly subdued in his presence. Though a few punters came along, the show that night was pretty much for his benefit, and I think he was suitably impressed. Afterwards, we were instructed to follow his car into the centre, and we eventually arrived at a multi-storey car park. He spoke to the security men, then assured us our equipment would be safe there, so we parked inside. We figured the restaurant must be in the area somewhere, but Big Maurice led us down to the canal's edge, where a small but elegant boat was moored up. He gestured us aboard, and for the next hour we were transported through the illuminated lagoons of Venice by night, Ophelia and the others observing our obvious delight at the way the evening was unfolding, like proud parents watching their kids on the fur. The boat eventually pulled up at the restaurant, Big Maurice's restaurant. You had to hand it to the guy. He knew how to show you a good time. After another sumptuous meal and not wanting the evening to end, we wandered off into Venice looking for a bar. The stunning Croatian waitress had joined us and offered to take us to a place she knew that might still be open. On the way, spotting a discarded rose and an opening, Al swooped down and presented it to her. She melted instantly, and he was in like Flynn. Full points to him for capitalising on the aura of this charmed night. We could do no wrong. We were carousing Lotharios, swaggering down leafy impasses, breathing in the heady romantic scent of magical Venice, and the spell continued when we arrived at Café Bleu. The owner was about to close, but the girl persuaded him to serve us one drink. And the normally tight purse strings were cast aside as one drink became a prolonged session. Before long, the owner grew curious as to what had brought us to Venice, and when we told him, his face lit up in recognition. He'd seen the posters that were in every street. He knitted his brow momentarily, and then hit us with it. Why not play there in his bar tomorrow night? At first, the suggestion seemed ludicrous. Impossible, even. But on this night, nothing was impossible, right? He said he could get a vocal PA and could print some flyers first thing if Phil was prepared to design one there and then. Slowly the idea began ingratiating itself, and he sweetened the pot by offering to tear up the sizeable tab we'd run up and keep it running free of charge until after the show. But what really swung it was the chance to play in the centre of Venice. He told us only two other bands had ever done it, Wings and Pink Floyd. Did we want to be the third? After the Floyd gig, the authorities had pulled the plug on further events for the fear of the adverse effects the decibels were having on the architecture. And besides, how were you meant to get your gear in? There are no roads. This led on to our next question, which the irrepressible Tony effortlessly vanquished with a single word. Gondola. By now, Little Morris and Co. were ready for bed, and before departing, at our request, cancelled our hotel for the night. So half the band agreed to go to Tony's place, Al left with the girl, and the rest of us slept on the floor of the bar. It seemed we weren't leaving Venice so hastily after all. I remember waking up under a cafe table with a grappa-induced hangover, as the realisation of what we had agreed to slowly dawned on me. In the cold light of day, it didn't seem such a bright idea. You couldn't swing a cat in the place. And where the fuck were the others? The day that unfurled is a string of hazy memories of toing and froing between Café Bleu and various other places. I remember handing out flyers on the Bridge of Sighs and the inevitable supermarket trip, and for some reason ending up sat in the front of the van with Bill. It had been moved from its haven in the car park and was now resting on the street outside, which is where our old friends the Guardia found us. They were far from happy with its location and demanded it be moved. Bill shrugged and looked at me with that, "Well, I can't do it, I'm pissed as usual," expression, and the appearance of a gun through the open window did little to persuade him otherwise. Evidently with Bill, its effectiveness as a deterrent had been blunted by overexposure. But it did the trick with me, and I bounded off to find Billy. We returned and he drove it down to the harbour some distance away, as this was the appointed rendezvous point for transporting the bulky equipment later. The smaller items would have to be carried by hand. When the time came, Phil and me found ourselves struggling along with amps and not making a very good job of it. There's a certain kind of simmering rage that can only be arrived at by excessive drinking and a lack of food and sleep. And once this confused, volatile state is achieved, you need only the tiniest preposterous circumstance to push you into full-blown psychosis. This is where Phil was at. He'd spent a large chunk of the day ringing his wife to explain that we wouldn't be home as planned, and she'd not taken the news well. As we huffed and puffed over bridges and canals, he kept up a running commentary that went something like this. "We must be fucking stupid. How fucking stupid are we? Oh yeah, we'll play in your fucking bar, for fuck's sake. What are we playing at?" etc. But he was preaching to the converted, for I had already moved on to the next stage, zombie-like acceptance. I'd given up the struggle and was passively resigned to my fate. Like a drowning man, there was no fight left in me. Let the chips fall where they may. I floated cork-like in the sea of my destiny, zen-like even. It was a state Billy would have given his right arm for. Quite what that would have done for his playing style is debatable, but it would have no doubt helped in his search for the sound of one hand clapping. Back at the harbour, they were loading gear onto what I can only describe as a motorised barge with wooden panels across it to create a flat surface. With each ripple of the water, it rocked precariously, necessitating someone holding onto and steadying the gear. I joined it on one run, clinging dearly to my Jupiter 8 in its huge silver flight case, for one slip would have sent it sinking without trace. The thing weighed a ton. The Jupiter 8 made more Top of the Pops appearances in the 80s than Adamant and Boy George put together, and outstripped the pair of them in looks, glamour, and outright sexiness. Its inimitable tones are littered over the music of the era, and none more so than ours. Make no mistake, if it was going down, I was going with it. Future generations would find my withered remains clinging to it in frozen adulation, like the robot kid in Artificial Intelligence. despite hangovers, barges, psychosis, and sheer improbability, we managed to get everything in the bar, set it up, and perform a rudimentary sound check. After 2 weeks of star treatment, it felt like being back to basics with only a backline and bloody-mindedness to hold us together. On home ground again, although I doubt Phil's wife would have agreed with the analogy. Now all we needed was what had been eluding us since Rome. An audience. At the appointed time, Tony opened the door and a crowd poured in, filling the place in under a minute. 10 minutes later, we emerged from a side room in full regalia to a ripple of appreciative applause. What had been eating us for the last few days was that without an audience, what's the point? And all the restaurants and hotels and cartoon cheese had been unable to submerge the fact. It just kept bubbling back up to the surface. So this unexpected last-minute reprieve manifested itself as a huge release of pent-up energy. We were firing on all cylinders as the frustrations and tensions formed themselves into one immense cathartic sonic blast, singeing eyebrows and blistering the paintwork. It was as if the tiny confines of Café Bleu seemed to squeeze and compress every song into its optimum tight muscular state. The audience reeled as the music pummeled them relentlessly, and Big Morris and the others were amongst them. What had the band ever done for us? It had brought us here to give us moments like this. After the concert, I chatted with Ophelia at the bar. She looked a little upset and admitted she'd been crying. She'd felt she'd let us down. I pointed out the ludicrousness of this statement, as in our entire career, no promoter had ever treated us with such kindness and respect, and I made sure she knew it. Big Morris had left, but she told us he'd booked us all into a hotel for the night and wanted to take us to lunch the next day, if we could spare the time. Phil grimaced and went to find a phone. I'm sure the gear must have stayed put for the night. I don't remember any moonlight shenanigans on the canal, but I do remember the hotel. It was like one of those crooked houses at the Fur designed to mess with your spatial awareness. And there was weird scrawled graffiti on the wall by the bed. It was in Italian, but I didn't need an interpreter to know it spelled, "Help me, I'm a psycho. The little voices make me do bad things." Don't get me wrong, I'm not sulking because they didn't put us in a 5-star suite overlooking San Marco Square. I'm just relating the weirdness. You could have put us in places like that for the whole tour, Ophelia, and believe me, you wouldn't have heard a peep of dissent. We're from St. Helens, not St. Moritz. The next day, Big Morris took us to a terrace framed by overhanging trees and vines, where we ate carbonara and tiramisu, drank Chianti, and discussed our bright future together. He'd seen something special in us, that was for sure. But if he was that astute, he could hardly have failed to notice that it was shot through with unpredictability and riddled with fault lines. He was a diamond merchant after all. He had an eye for it. Later that day, we parted company with the wonderful macaroni music and headed back to England. The route was peppered with the usual antics we'd come to expect, from being given $100 by a shit-scared coach driver who'd accidentally pranged our bumper in a car park. He took one look at the Mad Max extras who came leaping out and reached for his wallet, to the brakes failing during our descent of the French Alps, the legacy of the damage incurred on the way to Cesena, and only Al's nifty gear stick work saving us from a grisly death. I could expand on these events in more detail, dear reader, but hang on, for there are other places we need to go. Take your protein pills. To be continued.
Poisoned electric head. poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned electric, 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 poisoned electric head, poisoned electric head, poisoned electric.